church or something? Everybody's in the back. Could you come up and show it, I guess?
I don't know. They'll like this.
Don't want it for a tree either.
Is that what it is? You ready to go?
Ron Wilson and John Marshall.
Okay, we've got Ron Wilson and John Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And with me is Ron Wilson, OSBA's Director of Labor Relations. And we're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1181. And we're going to limit our comments to the Dash 5 amendments, a copy of which I think you have in front of you. And I'm going to ask Ron to take you through our testimony, which contains bulleted points about regarding the provisions of Senate Bill 1181 as amended, and then some arguments about why we think this is an important piece of legislation and urge your support.
Okay, thank you.
The Dash 5 amendment now apply to all school employees in a collective bargaining unit, so that would include both teachers as well as classified staff, and also applies to administrators. There are some significant changes between the Dash 5 amendment and the way the bill was originally introduced. Instead of, as in the original bill, there was a 3.8% factor that was applied, now that factor is to be determined by the Department of Administrative Services, and it's in the Office of Economic Analysis. They will calculate an allowable growth factor based on the total compensation for employees of school districts and ESDs. Now, that allowable growth factor is based on generally accepted economic indicators that reflect not only current market conditions within the state, but also forecasted state revenues. The bill, as amended, calls for the Department of Administrative Services on each January 1 to make a projection for the next 5 years. That would allow multiple-year collective bargaining agreements, and as each January 1 comes up, the Department of Administrative Services would make that new projection. This amendment also takes a current service level type approach to personnel costs. It includes all compensation, associated payroll taxes and payroll costs, contributions towards health insurance, but does not include costs that are associated with a growth or a decline in the number of students. This amendment still creates a safe harbor for public schools in lieu of bargaining if they make an offer that meets the DAS allowable growth factor and maintains contract language on all other issues. A school district or an ESD can still choose whether to make that offer or to negotiate a settlement that is either above or below that allowable growth factor.
So that doesn't stop the negotiation process, is that what you're saying?
No, it does not stop the negotiations process in that sense.
Okay.
But it does still allow a safe harbor that if the school district or ESD does meet that DAS allowable growth factor, then that offer will be incorporated into the collective bargaining agreement and bargaining ceases at that point. Now, if a school district or ESD does choose to make a offer that is above that DAS allowable growth factor, then they have to justify that offer and provide a rationale. That justification and rationale appears in a report that is released at a regular meeting of the school board, and copies of that report are given to the Department of Education, the President of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, included in the report is not only a fiscal impact statement on how that offer that's above the growth factor affects the budget, but is also an impact, or what impact that offer will have on student achievement. A school board cannot ratify a offer that is above the DAF allowable growth factor until at least 30 days after the release of that particular report. So that's a summary of the Dash 5 changes and what it does. We believe that this is these amendments are needed because that we need that a balance to be struck between the need for school districts to enhance programs and control costs balanced against the rights of employees. We believe that these amendments will return the focus of school districts to the education of children. By having the DAS do the calculate the allowable growth factor, they can calculate a factor which is taken out of the arena of collective bargaining, but which will provide some type of demarcation so that it's both affordable, in other words, it's within the revenue projections, but it's also an acceptable level of growth for personnel costs and based on generally acceptable indices. We believe this bill is also essential because it provides a safe harbor to avoid critical resources being diverted into collective bargaining and the cost of collective bargaining. However, there is within the bill a dispute resolution mechanism that if there is a dispute related to whether a school district has made that offer that meets the allowable growth factor, that can be appealed to the Employment Relations Board for final determination. These amendments allow flexibility for school boards both to meet local needs and to determine whether an offer is below, either meets it, or it can exceed the DAS allowable growth factor. That type of flexibility is needed because school boards have different needs throughout the state. Some school boards may wish to exceed the factor because of recruitment issues or providing additional staffing for student achievement purposes, and there may be a variety of rationales. There are a number of trends that we believe are indicative of what's happening in school districts. Certainly there's a demand for increased fiscal and program accountability. We've had high demands for compensation from teacher groups, our negotiated settlements, class size, time for instruction, demands of higher levels of student achievement. We have some a page attached to our testimony that will give you kind of some of the highlights of some of those issues. But all of these issues and all of these trends are putting increased pressure on school boards not only to be more accountable for results, but to have both cost containment and cost control so that we can focus on the key work of school boards, which is improving student achievement. And we believe that Senate Bill 1181-5 is an important step in that process.
Okay. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
The bottom line to me seems like you're trying to stop your school boards from being able to do their worst, which is giving out pay increases. I mean, I know there's a lot of pressure. At this point in the session, I probably don't feel too sympathetic to other elected officials who are feeling pressure, but it's a negotiation, and your school boards have as much authority as the other side has, and now you're trying to take away their ability to do that process, or limit it, not take it away, just limit it.
I think that limitation is correct, but it's also a balance. It's a limitation on one hand, but it's also, frankly, the not having to go through a long, involved bargaining process when, indeed, you have an acceptable level of growth that you can put on the table.
Acceptable to one side.
Well, I don't know that. And the reason I don't know that is that the previous bill had a specific point, a 3.8%. This amendment doesn't really identify what that level is. And it takes it out of that arena between school districts or school boards and labor organizations because we have some other third party identifying what that level is. So I can't tell you at this point where that level is going to be, what that DAS allowable growth factor is actually going to describe. If it's too high, then probably it's not going to be a whole lot of benefit to school boards. If it's too low, it's probably going to be the same thing. It's not going to be a whole lot of benefit to many school boards, maybe a few. It's got to be somewhere in between, but I don't know precisely where that DAF allowable growth factor is going to be. And a lot is going to depend on what types of numbers they come up with.
Are school boards really giving away too much now in negotiated salaries?
Mm-hmm. I have to talk about what you mean by too much.
Well, you were saying if it was too high, then it didn't do school boards any good, and the same if it was too low. So I figure you must have some idea out there as to what's enough but not too much. And the fact that you're coming trying to limit it at all tells me that your boards must be giving away too much and not be able to limit it themselves.
The amount of pressure that's on a school board from our statewide labor unions is incredible. I think during our last testimony we talked about there are some power imbalances. But there are certain trends that we can see statewide, and I can't talk about specific school districts. But I do know that the average salary for teachers has risen at a quicker pace than the national average, usually at about 10% more, as the fact sheet that's attached to our testimony will indicate.
That's a bad thing?
If that was in and of in itself, no, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. We're expecting more teachers. They are working harder. But when I take a look at some of the other trends, I have to start asking some questions. One is class size is increasing. The number of instructional days has been decreasing. So we have to ask ourselves, if we're really going to truly focus on student achievement, we're going to have the ability to reallocate our financial resources in a different way. And that's really what this bill allows us to do. It gives another tool in the toolbox, but it's not a panacea, and it's not a sure thing that is going to tip the balance so far in the favor of school boards and school districts that collective bargaining is going to be a slam dunk. That's not what these amendments do.
I think, really, at least from my viewpoint, the real problem is we have a school board spending the money we're paying for it. We have no control over what they, there's no incentive for them to negotiate a tight contract when they have to pay the bill. And there's going to be a limit as to how much dollars the states can be willing to give them. We have to have some way of controlling that growth. And I don't know how you're going to do it. In other words, you've got to come up with some answer on this on the problem. Eventually, there's a limit to what the public is going to give us for running state government, including schools. And if you're going to continue to give more and more schools, you're going to take it away from human resources and roads and highways and whatever other things the state government does.
I think if we go very much further in this direction, we need to acknowledge what Senator Duncan is always telling us he doesn't want to see, and that's that we are the school board for the state of Oregon, and that we will determine how much can be spent in all of these different categories.
We are the school board.
But short of acknowledging that and saying this is how much you can, doing statewide collective bargaining or something like that, short of that, then I think we need to, it needs to be one way or the other.
We certainly have a choice. We can go to statewide collective bargaining, and that would be the other option that we can do if that's something you would rather do. I don't know how else you're going to control it if you don't have some controls from it. I don't think the controls that they're being asked to stay within is unreasonable.
The local voters used to be the control.
Mm-hmm. And I would be happy to take it back there. and let them decide how to get the money out of the taxpayers. Right now, they spend the money to say, here's the bill you pay for.
Mr. Chair, if I might illuminate a little bit on your point, prior to 1990, you would have never seen us anywhere near supporting a piece of legislation like this. What we're trying to do is deal with the new reality of what we like to call not a state-funded school system, but a state-funded system of schools. You're now providing the bulk of the resources. In the old days, a collective bargaining agreement was signed and then it was left up to local citizens to decide the extent to which they wanted to pay for it through tax bases and levies. We no longer have that right or that responsibility. So the question is, now that you're providing the bulk of the funds, you have a legitimate fiduciary interest in assuring that the funds are wisely spent as well as spent within the constraints of the amount of money you give us. So there are two different ways we could go. We could go, as Senator Gerstler suggests, to a full-fledged statewide bargaining where we handed everything over to you. We don't believe that's appropriate, nor possible, to balance the interests of 198 school districts with varying degrees of difference. So we can't, we believe, continue on the same road of pre-Measure 5, nor are we willing to go so far as to statewide bargaining or statewide salary schedule. So the issue is, on that spectrum, what point can we possibly balance your interests against ours? And that is of locally elected officials still making determinations that best fit the needs of their own community. I believe that there will be school districts that will see a need to exceed this allowable growth limit. And I think it will be because they want to recruit and retain good staff. They will want, in the Portland area, for example, there is a tremendous competition for principals. And school districts are going to have to pay good dollars in order to recruit and retain good principals. And I believe that there are rational reasons why a school district ought to be allowed to go over this allowable growth. But it does create a target, and it does put folks on notice that these are going to be the resources, these are what the economists view as a rational level of growth. And if you're going to exceed it, then you're going to have to come up with rational reasons for it. And to me, it strikes a balance that we're all looking for. You obviously can make a decision at some point and decide to treat school districts like the Department of Agriculture. Treat us as a state agency. You don't need 198 school districts. You can run everything out of the Department of Ed with the State Board of Education being a statewide school board. I don't think you want to do that. I don't think it's wise from a policy perspective, nor do I think it's wise politically. You still need folks in their community where parents and citizens can get their hands on somebody that's close that's making the decisions. And I think we need that those elected officials in each individual community. By the same token, I think it's appropriate to come up with some mechanism to put those folks on notice that there are limits, that you're providing the bulk of the funds, and you're going to have your economists say what's a rational level of growth and make those local officials accountable for either going under that or over it. And I think it's worthy of an effort, and it does, in fact, strike the balance that we're looking for.
Thank you.
I just want to say, before I do have some amendments, do you know that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. A minute ago, we were talking about the increases in salaries from 40% to 50%, and Senator Duke says, is that bad? Well, at noon I went out and talked to some kids, neat kids and teachers from our school district, and then they were allowing us to speak from the microphone. And this hysterical cloud led by these teachers that had an increase in wages more than 10% of the national average in the last 10 years was having these kids worked up to into a frenzy. So I couldn't speak because I was talking about what the product being delivered instead of just more money. And they were screaming, no more cuts, no more cuts, no more cuts, louder and louder. And yes, it's bad, Senator Duke, because those teachers are telling those kids with legislation doesn't care. We're cutting programs. Well, for the last 10 years, they've had wages that increase that is 10% higher than the national average. And so I think that for the teachers to bring these kids down here and, like I said a minute ago, and be all in a frenzy as though we're cutting their programs when there's only so much money to go around, 58% of the budget's a lot for education. But anyway, individually, when I spoke with teachers in the back of the class, for my district, and we talked about what was really going on in the schools, and one of the teachers and some of the kids said how that by they claim legislative design, we have to teach English, then we teach some history, and then they are tested on their science test for 2 weeks or whatever, and that the testing is all off. And then it's mandated by the legislature, and then if the kids aren't learning what they're supposed to, then we're going to cut their wages or maybe cut their jobs from them. And there's something going on inside the school besides just this money situation. And when you said, if we have this, then we can concentrate on other things, which I think are more important than the wages, is that we are holding these kids up to a standard that they can never reach. And so after, I don't know, a teacher from Springfield was telling us, after 5 or 6 years, every year they read their report and it's permanent portfolio says does not meet the standards. How many years till these kids figure out they're dumb? And we'll get it figured out. We'll remove the things that are wrong about the school reform in time. But in the meantime, I just feel so bad for these kids. And I wish we would, the school board, you say you're, you know, the school board's job, I wish the school board would stand up to the legislature or stand up to ever whomever is requiring this experiment to continue. I know Vera Katz, one of them, because she said it's an ethics, a failure, but for goodness sake, don't stop. Keep this failing system. But anyway, I think our testing system is wrong-headed, and especially that we're going to fire teachers because the kids don't test high enough and they don't have time to teach the kids. But anyway, before the testing. But I have a question about what you mean about on page 2, section 3, the Oregon Department of Industry Services shall calculate the allowable growth factor, the total combined compensation, using generally accepted economic indicators, such as for compensation or cost for employees of school districts. Are the economic indicators the same in Burns, Oregon, as Beaverton? What are these economic indicators? And that's one question. And teachers are recruited for districts. I mean, that's what people told me in Jervis. We have a huge turnover because the teachers can do better in Salem or better in Clackamas County, higher wages. So they recruit these teachers out to higher wages. But like in Burns, a janitor, whether he's being a janitor at Safeway or the janitor at school, is paid the same. How I'm not so sure that classified employees should be in this. And I really need a little bit, I know I was late, but I'd like a little more information about the administrators, because I think it's really something. How many administrators in schools that have clients 9 months out of the year and have to evaluate teachers 9 months out of the year? And I know they recruit in the summer, and I know I'm married to an administrator. I know they work all year long. But still, they all, so many, earn more than the governor of the whole state. Oh, yes, the governor's underpaid. But, you know, what is your handle? You talked about the representative group. What is it about administrators? Because sometimes we give the school districts more money, and I swear the school boards think the administrators are going to die in the next 2 years, so they have to up their salary. So they take all these trips or whatever. But I would like to know what kind of handle you're going to put on administrators.
I think one of the advantages of this particular amendment is that it is relatively even-handed across all three employee groups, whether it's teachers, classified employees, or administrators. When the Department of Administrative Services looks at the generally accepted economic indicators for compensation, some of the things that come to my mind would be, for instance, the Consumer Price Index, and a variety of other types.
Is that the same out of Portland area as it is in the Portland area?
I would think not, although the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't really have an Oregon CPI. They have, of course, a national CPI, and they have a Portland. See, the new one is the Portland, Vancouver, Salem Metropolitan Service Area Consumer Price Index. I know that's a mouthful. One of the things that this allowable growth factor should do from the Office of Economic Analysis, it should take those factors as well as those regional factors into consideration. Now, what happens if a specific district says, well, our needs in terms of recruitment, for instance, or retention are greater than that factor? Well, the strength of this particular amendment, it would allow a school district with the report that justifies it and gives the rationale for
exceeding that allowable growth factor would still allow them to do that. So if they have difficulty in, as John was saying, in retaining or recruiting administrators, or if they have difficulties in retaining or recruiting teachers or classified staff, there is a mechanism with that rationale that they can solve that problem. I think the third point that you raised was, well, how are districts going to handle administrative groups versus teacher groups or versus classified groups? Again, the strength of this particular amendment allows a school board to make that decision locally. And I'm not sure that that decision can be made at the Department of Administrative Services in terms of that allowable growth factor, because the state is too large, and with all of the 198 districts, their needs vary from district to district. What I think that the Department of Administrative Services can do is can draw a line in the sand and say, if you meet that, that seems reasonable from the statewide perspective. But then but the bill still allows school boards to vary from that depending upon their individual needs.
Yeah. Another question? Mm-hmm. You don't have a problem then or a concern that paying the teachers, the principal, the classified, janitors, and Burns or K-Falls, the same janitors' wages in Portland so that they'll have fewer janitors but more higher pay. Is that a concern?
I think that it would be a concern, but what I think that this bill does is it identifies what the growth factor would be, not necessarily dictating that a janitor in K-Hall should be paid as the same as a custodian or a janitor in Portland. I think that's what this avoids doing.
So that's not the legislative intent?
No, no.
Okay.
As I read this, the compensation, looking at your bullet points, amendment takes current service level approach, all personnel costs, which appears to me to say that then that we're also including step increases.
Yes, we are. Within the definition of compensation, and that's on page 1 on line 17.
So then the roll-up would also include those step increases.
Yes, sir, it would.
As salary increases. We've never recognized that fact in negotiations, as far as I've been able to discern, that step increases are part of compensation increase.
From our perspective, steps are real money.
That's always been my view of it as well.
Well, I still find it really interesting that when you listen to the conversation that's going on here, it's where the purpose of schools is for jobs for teachers. And we keep forgetting what the job of schools are. The schools are to educate kids. So we seem to always be in the argument of schools are for jobs for teachers. And when we talk about these things, class size, as an example, salaries are going to have an influence on class size. We can continue to give present teachers more and more money, but then you're going to raise class sizes. And either that or you're going to have to come up with more dollars from taxation. I mean, there's a finite amount of money out there, and I think you ought to be looking at what's best for kids and not always what's best for teachers. Or employees, of course.
Yeah, I agree.
You always lose that argument for some reason. We're always talking about what's good for teachers and what's good for employees. And the purpose of having a school is to educate kids. Why don't you talk about what's best for kids?
I can answer that.
Can you?
Yes, because people come up with these ideas and their ego gets involved and they would do anything and say, other than say, I was wrong, we need to take a correction here or there. They just keep going headlong, we're going to send the wrong message. And we do need to listen to the teachers and we do need to listen to the students and have a real open discussion about what's happening in the school. That's my opinion.
Any other questions for this gentleman? Thank you both for your time. We have James Frager and Tim Nesbitt. Maybe they have Steve Lanning, too, by the next level.
Chairman Durfler, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak with the Oregon Education Association. I wasn't on your sign-up list, I apologize. Okay. With me today is the OEA President, Jim Sager. We and several of our members in April testified against the original version of Senate Bill 1181, and while we recognize that the Dash 5 amendments differ in some significant ways from the original bill, some of the same principles that on the grounds on which we opposed 1181 still apply with the Dash 5 amendments. So we do oppose the Dash 5 amendments. I would say one overarching theme, and I'll let Jim talk about some of the specifics in the amendment itself, is that it undercuts the bargaining process and violates the tenets of the collective bargaining statute that this seeks to amend. There was discussion in the earlier testimony about creating power imbalances, and we feel like that this will create some of those new power imbalances that the statute currently doesn't contemplate. So with that, just kind of over broad view of the Dash 5 amendments, if I could defer to Mr. Sager and let him talk about the amendment itself.
Thank you. Chairman Durfler and members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager, president of OEA. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. As Tricia mentioned, the fundamental principles that we object to are the same. Not to try and sound flip, but the analogy of it's a solution looking for a problem is the way we look at it. The assumption here is that the collective bargaining agreements are the only things that drive up the cost. What about, for instance, the cost of contracts to private providers, et cetera, Laidlaw transportation? This does not address the overall business cost that a school district has to face in coming years. And in fact, we believe that the information that OSBA provided you, as well as some facts that I'll share with you in a minute, show that the settlements lately have been very reasonable. Then between 1989 and 97, private industry wages increased 42.6%. Now, that's despite lumber and the wood products industry having a downturn. During that same time, the wages for public elementary and secondary school rose an average of 33.9% or 33.5% or a little over 9% less than the statewide average for private industry. So if we're looking for comparisons, and that's just overall, there are very specific areas, banking, accounting, and others that grew at an even faster rate. The Portland CPIU, and you're right, we don't have a state number, but we can all use the Portland CPIU, between 89 and 97 increased 36.2%, while school wages increased 33.5%. So, again, did not even keep up with inflation. So we've actually lost ground to... That is the cost, yes.
All the other costs in terms of benefits.
Correct. What ends up happening, and I'll digress a little bit, what ends up happening so often with statistics, and I appreciate the footnote that OSBA put in their testimony, when you're talking about averages or trying to compare those things, part of the reason Oregon, the percentage appears to increase faster, for instance, than the national, is because we've gone through a long period of time where we have not been hiring very many new employees in our school, especially teachers. And so as people have progressed through both experience and additional training, the average, so to speak, has moved, even though the salaries as opposed to inflation, et cetera, have not been keeping track. But it's an artificial number. The other question I guess we have to ask is, just because ours went up faster, it may be because the others were even more insignificant or not able to keep up with the needs in their state. And we just don't have that kind of comparison, at least I don't at the moment. This unilateral imposition of a qualified economic offer, it effectively undermines the whole collective bargaining process, both economically and on language issues, which so oftentimes, and we have I've been here, I've testified before you before about how important a number of the language issues, for instance, are in the collective bargaining process to deal specifically with safety of students, student achievement, professional development opportunities for our staff members so that they, in fact, can do an even better job with students, because we are challenging ourselves to do more. You're absolutely right in saying that we need to focus on students, but we also can look at the results that came out of Wisconsin just about a year ago, where they did a comparison across this country looking at student achievement. And in those school districts where we have properly trained and certified unionized teachers is where the highest student achievement consistently took place. Now, that's because we take real pride in what we do. I take pride in being an elementary teacher. I'm not just the union president. I'm an elementary teacher. And when I'm dealing with students, when my colleagues are dealing with students, that's what we're focused on. I'll share a couple experiences I've had with some other teachers in just a minute. I think that, as Tricia mentioned, this really does violate the whole tenet of the collective bargaining process. We were looking for, back in 73, a way to, and I'll quote, create harmonious and cooperative relationships between government employees, equality of bargaining power between public employees and employers and public employees. We were looking for ways to reduce strife and reduce unrest. And over the past several years, we, both OEA, the other unions, and School Boards Association, have been working to find new ways even to address collective bargaining so that we can move away from the more positional, traditional confrontational approach to a collaborative model. The collaborative model requires that you sit down and you identify what are the challenges that we are facing on both sides of the table, all sides of the table, and how can we together come up with solutions to that. My biggest fear is that this kind of approach is going to put an end to that collaboration, because the fear is going to be that, oh my gosh, we're going to have to file a report because we discovered that we're outside of some sort of artificial parameter that doesn't meet the needs that we have here. And the surprising part is that there is a natural limit that is built into the process. The state legislature determines how much money the school districts are going to get. That is our natural limit. And if we choose, collectively choose, because remember, these are agreements that both sides agree to. If we collectively choose that we have to have a certain kind of agreement that would fall outside of these parameters, then we now find ways to make those adjustments. 2 years from now, when we would come to the legislature, I'm not quite sure how that prevents the need for additional money if we are trying to raise standards for students, if we're trying to get more students to meet the high standards, if we need additional services to provide for the students. The natural limit already exists, and that's the amount of money that you allocate to it. So there doesn't have to be some artificial parameters inside of that natural limit. There are so many wonderful examples of, when I talked about the collaborative bargaining relationship, there's so many wonderful examples of districts that have gone through this after having years and years of really combative experiences. But one that's very close to me was in St. Helens, because I helped with the process. And the previous, like, three contracts, they had been at loggerheads, and the whole community was divided. And what we decided is both sides said we'd sit down and we'd find a different way. And so we used the OEA-OSBA collaborative bargaining model, and we followed it. And when we were done, we had a party. I mean, it was just such a wonderful coming together. We didn't have to worry about these artificial parameters. We knew what the funding levels were for the district. We knew what the challenges and concerns were for all sides. And that is the kind of relationship that we need to be fostering and trying to build up.
What's your question?
Sure.
Did you have to cut any programs after that visit?
There were some changes made in the way funding was done, but to say that it was a program cut, it was really a different approach to provide the service is what happened in that.
See what happens, they bargain for higher wages, and we get the blessing or the clerk is saying we kept the program.
I won't dispute that, and I guess my question is, in 2 years, I don't, if we want to increase standards, if we want to provide greater opportunities for our students, we're constantly going to have that tug of war between the provider of the resources and the provider of the service.
Hey, you make it sound like it's all easy, sweet, rosy, bargaining.
Absolutely not. It's very tough.
It's not what happened in Stony Ridge. It's not what happened in Sandy. It's not what happened. We have 190 school districts, and you're making it sound like you guys sit down and you all hold hands and decide what you're going to do. That isn't the process. I get letters from school board people telling us the way you guys have treated your, not only them, but also their students in school.
Senator Gerfler, I appreciate the letters, and I don't dispute that there are people that feel that way. But I can tell you, I've been at the bargaining table with over 24 contracts. I know how hard the work is. I know how tough it is at times to address the concerns and the issues that parties have. But we have to be able to have that kind of give and take and that kind of dialogue in order to really address the problem.
You have to arrest the kids in school?
I would differ with you that we harass any students. And
some letters from school board members.
I'm sure, Senator Driffler, I appreciate the fact that, you know, that you've received the letters, and
sit there and say everything is hunky-dory, and all we do is sit down and hold hands and decide how they're going to divide the money.
I hope you do not interpret my testimony that way. I'm trying to talk about what it is we need to do and the efforts that can be made, and trying to address how this is going to interfere with that process. One other comment before I close. Last week, I had the opportunity to talk with two young teachers. One was just finishing his second year, and one was finishing his fourth year. And it really saddened me because they were both leaving the state and leaving the profession. And it, although they weren't pleased, I mean, the jobs they ended up going to were paying them much more. It wasn't the salary as much that swayed them. It was the fact that in addition to the salary, compared to other professions being low, it was the environment and the feeling that they're constantly under attack and being challenged. And I'm not saying that that is your intent. It is the feeling that we're getting as educators that somehow all of the economic challenges that we have are our fault when we're trying to focus our energies and our expertise on helping students meet high standards. Whether we agree with the current high standards, the fact is we want students to achieve high standards, and it's that relationship that is really disturbing to people.
Well, I know these young teachers too, and you know one reason they're lazy? It's because the teachers that have been there so long are making such wages. I know teachers that have been there a long time, and just in the last 3 days, one teacher said to me how difficult her situation is. When I asked her, why doesn't she leave? She says, there's no place. I can't find a job where I can work 9 months out of the year, earn these kind of wages with these kind of benefits. And in a way, that's your concern and fault. This is just your fault, if it is our fault, because it was the Beaverton School Board member that told me, we pay low at the beginning so that they'll stick around and reach the high. And maybe some of you teachers that are up at this end of it, that have fantastic wages considering compared to the ones that are getting out of it, maybe there's a little responsibility there with you too, instead of just the legislature not giving you enough money.
Yeah, Chairman, before Senator Shannon, I appreciate your comments, and I guess it really does depend upon how you look at it. If the really high isn't high, but it's high compared to the really low, then it's sort of an example. My stepson just graduated from the University of Oregon last year. My wife is an over 20-year teacher, master's degree, top-notch teacher. He started off at a salary higher than she makes. And that's his beginning salary. So, no, he's not teaching. He's in private industry. But I'm talking about the relationship. So now I don't begrudge him at all for making that kind of money. But my illustration is that this top of the Portland salary schedule salary compared to a bachelor's degree person.
Let me just make
those are relationships.
I'm a teacher. I knew from the sixth grade on I was going to have summers off. and I knew it my senior year in college. I wasn't going to make the same as my friends and classmates that were qualifying for 12-month jobs. And that we make choices. And the teachers made their choice for all the different reasons. Some men wanted to paint houses in the summer. Some wanted to go fishing in Alaska. They make choices. And a teacher doesn't earn the same as anybody that qualifies. That's their education. Pursues it for a 12-month job.
I understand. I do appreciate that. You're right. There are choices that have been made, and that's why it was so enlightening for me to have those two young teachers who chose to go into this profession, who knew what the salary schedules were, to say that when it came to that balancing, it wasn't just salary recognizing the difference because they chose it, but it was really the environment and the feeling of constantly being under attack. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm the executive director of the Oregon State Council of SEIU, which represents 28,000 public and private sector employees in Oregon, including 650 classified employees in the Portland School District. I'm also a Portland parent, and in fact, my daughter started first grade the year after Measure 5 passed in 1990-91. And since then, her class sizes have gotten larger. Seen, I think, only one textbook that she's brought home since then that postdates Measure 5, 1990. And by the way, I myself, as a taxpayer, have not seen my property tax bills go down. And I think I'm in a situation similar to that of many Portland parents. But the problem is not the salaries being paid to Portland teachers or classified employees. As a matter of fact, in Portland now, the funding for that school district is at a lower level per capita per student than it was in 1990. The problem is overall funding. And I think the proposal we see before us in Senate Bill 1181 is targeting the wrong problem. The problem has to be adequate funding for our schools, and that means funding those educators who are required to provide the teaching we expect for our children and funding them fairly. But also, in my role as a union representative and as someone who's bargained contracts here in the state, here opposite your representatives of the state of Oregon and opposite those cities and counties around the state, I want to comment on some of the implications for those of us who care about our bargaining law in the public sector. Two sessions ago, this legislative assembly made significant changes to PECPA in Senate Bill 750 based on the theory that some subjects, so-called permissive subjects, like those affecting the assignment of work, should be left to management's discretion. But the argument was made then that these changes to PECPA did not diminish bargaining rights over core issues like pay and benefits. Now we have Senate Bill 1181, whose proponents want to have it both ways. Having narrowed the scope of bargaining over non-economic issues, this bill in its original form takes dead aim at the most fundamental subject of bargaining, pay and benefits, and in its revised Dash 5 amendments would in effect eliminate all bargaining once a particular offer is made. Senate Bill 1181 creates an arbitrary ceiling on the obligation to bargain over pay and benefits. And we oppose any ceiling on the right to bargain over any issue that's now not prohibited from bargaining. If you believe in the right of workers to bargain collectively, you allow the bargaining process to determine what is reasonable and affordable. Collective bargaining may have its foul lines that set limits on what can be bargained, and what can be bargained, the mandatory and the permissive. But it cannot function when the end zone for bargaining can be set unilaterally by either party. Senate Bill 1181 not only tilts the playing field, but it changes the game. The process that ends with a unilateral qualified economic offer, or what's now being called an allowable growth factor offer, is not bargaining. Let's be honest, Senate Bill 1181 will eliminate collective bargaining. Further, it imposes a ceiling on bargaining, which is quite arbitrary. What's the justification for a number like 3.8% in the original bill, or a number like it, which may be the number determined by the calculation of an allowable growth factor, when, for instance, let's assume we were in a school district at a period of double-digit inflation, or in a situation where market forces create high demand for teachers or other staff, or if temporary budget constraints have put one district far behind another and they need to catch up? In all those situations, we would need the latitude, the school board would need the latitude, and the union would need the latitude to bargain over increases above an arbitrary limit like that established by an allowable growth factor. Finally, I want to point out, in effect, what SB 1181 is proposing is a form of wage controls, which ought to be anathema to all defenders of the free market, including those who defend free collective bargaining. It's arbitrary. It establishes a factor which would allow cessation of bargaining. It would turn what's now a bilateral process into a unilateral process. It would turn bargaining, which school boards control, and budgeting, which you control, into a bureaucratic exercise that the Bean County will control in determining an allowable growth factor. We think it's a bad idea. We think it's unnecessary. We think it unfairly targets the wrong people. And we think the solution that we should be looking at is adequate funding for our schools and throughout the state.
I have one. Go ahead. Do you bargain for a private employees union or a public employees union?
In my current capacity, I'm not bargaining for either. I'm overseeing a union council. In the past, I've bargained in both the public sector and the private sector.
Is the union council public employees or private employees?
Public and private both.
Public and private. I don't know. I want to say it kindly if I can, but there are a lot of people in Oregon that aren't they are not in employment of the public, and they believe there's two classes. People in Oregon, the public employees who have the best retirement, the best vision, the best health insurance, and good wages, and then the rest of the state. And I think that in a way this bill is trying to get a handle on that, and it's coming from the people that aren't necessarily in public employment.
As a Portland parent, I don't think our teachers or our staff in the Portland schools are overpaid. But if there is a perception that they are, I believe that process, that the solution then lies with the Portland School Board and the Portland parents to get involved in budget deliberations, as I have. And so we'll come to a resolution of what's the proper funding for all.
And that, I think that's where we keep talking about the problem, and we just address the problem. The problem is that the school board does negotiate that, then they bring the bill to us to say, pay the bill. We have nothing to say about what they settle for. If we're going to have that type of a program, I think the only alternative is for us then to do the bargaining at the state level. And I guess that would be the alternative to this. And that's probably something that we'll have to take a look at.
Senator, I believe you, in your budget deliberations, look at the current service level based on inflation, based on expected student enrollment, and that gives you a number which you put in the budget. And I don't believe that any of the economic settlements in the Portland School District, for instance, in the last 9 years have exceeded that.
The current service level, if the current schools at the current service level, it would be 4.5. And you're asking for 4.95. And how can you say that it can be funded at the current service level? Is that dissatisfactory? I don't think so.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work the same in all school districts, generally. And I think the district solution is something we're
talking about. The problem is that we don't have the opportunity of negotiating the expense. We only have the ability to pay for what the school boards bring us to bill for. And that doesn't work. It wouldn't work in anybody's life. Unless there's some way of controlling that cost, the only other way to do it would be for us to go to a straight life argument situation. If we're going to pay the bill, you ought to be able to say what's going to be first for that bill.
Senator, as a Portland parent, I've just completed serving on an audit committee, which looked at the findings of an audit done in all areas of the school board's operations and budget, and spent a lot of valuable time, a lot of time into that effort to squeeze every available dollar out of the budget and out of the, in fact, out of the infrastructure by selling or leasing or renting out schools. There'd be other ways to raise revenue. And with the recent settlement of a 3% increase for the teachers and the classified employees, that number is not above the increase that...
Is that the only increase in salary? If I were to look at the salary, would it have only gone up 3% totally across the board in teachers? What about the step increases and those types of things?
I can answer that a little bit. Because of the fact that we've had in Portland, for instance, retirement of top-end teachers and hiring of new teachers just recently, the cost increase came in at 3%. That is, the payroll cost increase came in at 3%. I think it was 3.1.
The fact is, though, that the teachers on the SIP in the Portland district are getting between 5.92% and 8% annual increase under the new contract.
Senator Starr, you're asking if that's accurate?
I'm saying that's the report I have before
right,
me here.
That OSBA prepared?
Right.
Right, people that half of the bargaining unit roughly that are still moving towards the professional salary level, which takes a minimum of 14 years to make it, would receive that kind of an increase, yes.
5%?
5.9 to 8%.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just say one more thing. This weekend a teacher told me, actually she said, I'm about to become a Democrat because we're always under attack. So I said, what have you lost since the Republicans have been in control? Have you lost your vision insurance? Have you lost wages? Have you lost what? And you said that, teachers under attack. What if the teachers that you represent, have they lost wages in the last 10 years? No, they're down higher than 10% above the national average. Have they lost benefits? Why are the teachers complaining? What are they losing? What have they lost?
Senator Shannon, we have to look at individual districts and the sense that people have.
Any district, just which district?
I'll give an example. Teachers in the Corvallis School District, I think they went somewhere near 5 years with frozen salaries. A Tiger Tualatin District, which just recently completed their bargaining, they had, I believe it was either 2 or 3 years of frozen salaries. So that's why averages don't always stand up. If not staying up with inflation isn't a reduction, then we have a difference of opinion.
Don't have inflation.
The additional sense of feeling is the, and I can only characterize it as feeling under attack. When we look at, as Nesbitt pointed out, we look at agreements that we felt came about in Senate Bill 750 a couple of years ago that changed the collective bargaining agreement that haven't even hardly been in place yet, and now we're already changing them again to say, well, you know, we need more and we need to go further, then those attacks are on me as a professional, me as an individual. You can't not feel that way. Even if your paycheck stayed the exact same dollar amount, that is the feeling that you have because of the kinds of discussions and legislation going on, rather than us sitting down and collectively talking about how it is we can meet needs of students. And it is a different approach.
Let me suggest something to you. When we talked to the governor about this issue, he said sit down and talk to the school boards were asked to sit down and talk to you folks and try to come up to some agreement. The school board people said that you people refused to sit down and talk to them.
Senator Driffler, I'm not...
Why can you say that you're trying to work these things out?
Senator Driffler, I'm not sure who it is you are talking to, because no one from the school boards association came to speak to me. We had conversations back before the legislative session about trying to focus on the 95% of the education agenda that we agree wholeheartedly on it, working on position.
He suddenly told me he had asked to meet you folks and you refused to meet with him.
Senator Dorfler, I on the subject of Senate Bill 1180, Mr. Dudley did ask to meet with the OSBA, and I was the one representative who met with him on that bill. On this particular issue, we've not been approached to meet with the OSBA on it.
You did on 1180, and you refused to sit down and talk to him.
No, I did sit down and talk to him. Well, we did sit down and go over the amendments that OSBA was proposing, so I guess I'm not clear on any refusal to meet because that was not our intention. Excuse me?
I perhaps got some incorrect information, but I was told by Mr. Dudley he did ask, and you refused to sit down and talk to him.
As far as I'm concerned, we did. We sat down and went over an amendment that was proposed to 1180 before it came before your committee, went through it rather thoroughly. We obviously had some differences of opinion on it, which you heard in testimony last week, but yes, we did.
Okay. Did I have some incorrect information?
In Corvallis, you mentioned Corvallis?
Yeah.
Are you aware of the situation? They emptied out the pot for the teachers. They're about to come up with the deficit.
You mean in the recent settlement?
No, I mean in their ending balance. Corvallis has a little bit of a problem. I mean, it sounded as though Corvallis teachers couldn't get a raise because the board wasn't, you know, being generous. They didn't.
Well, I'd like to ask you, do you perceive that we have a problem in the fact that we only get to pay the bill if the school boards bring it? Is that not to be a problem for you?
Senator, I guess I have a different view of your comment.
Okay.
Hopefully in the near future, you will be preparing a budget for the coming biennium for school districts, and that both the amount of money and the allocation system will be sent out to the schools, and they will know over the next 2 years how much money they can expect to have. Whether they are just now entering into negotiations, whether it's with Laid Law Transportation for their buses or with their employees or with suppliers of their paper products, they're going to know what their parameters are, and they're going to have to live within those parameters or make adjustments within the budget to cover all the costs. So that's a natural process that we go through in schools and in businesses. So I'm not, 2 years from now, these school districts are going to come back, I would suspect, and say, if you want, legislature, if you want us to do these additional things with students, maintain the level of service and do these other things for students that you've asked us to do, we're going to need this much money. It may be more than the amount that is currently allocated. I would guess it would be because things will go up in cost. That process doesn't change, but there's a natural limit. You set it. If you determine, and the governor signs a budget of 4.725, that's what school districts are going to live under. If you determine a budget different than that, that is the amount of money that they're going to live under. And that's why I say there's this natural limit that is set, and you get to set it. We don't. And then we have to figure out how to provide services to students and meet the various needs. And it's broader than just the negotiated agreements with employees. It's the negotiated agreements for all products and services that the district has to enter into.
The difficulty is that all of those agreements are negotiated in an atmosphere of what's left over after salaries and benefits. And you've got such a huge percentage of the budget involved in salaries and benefits. And the fact that we can't seem to come to grips with the fact that the steps are, in fact, real money. They are increases. And when we talk about a 3% increase, we're giving teachers 8% increase through the step process, there's a big difference. And that is real dollars, and it is increased wages. In industry, where I work, when we give an increase, we give an increase that reflects the return of value to the employer that will approximate or at least cover the amount of the increase. We give increases in our schools, and we find that with an 8% increase to some and a 3% at the beginning step, we have in fact imposed increases much greater than the CPIU or whatever, and we're now dealing with an issue where we have to adjust our maintenance program. We have to adjust our class sizes, our course offerings, in order to compensate to maintain some kind of balance between available revenues and the total package of school costs. That, in fact, puts us in a really tough position as those responsible legislators who would try to take care of all of the responsibilities of our government and provide enough funds to adequately school our children. I think this measure, in fact, is a balance. On testimony, and the last time we heard this issue, there's only one other jurisdiction, I guess, that has enacted such legislation, and they found that 5% or so of the ongoing negotiations actually utilized this offer as the culmination of the bargaining. In fact, they bargained for less or they bargained for more. In 5% of the cases, when they reached current impasse, they used the cap. I think that is a reasonable solution and a good way to bring labor relations, labor management relations, into an agreeable balance.
Senator Driscoll, may I address Senator Senator Starr, I think you're speaking about Wisconsin and the testimony we received. I think it's important, though, that I point out that in Wisconsin, they do have local levy control, so that they still can go to the locals if they need to. They also do not also control the language issues, so that they still have a myriad of professional safety issues, et cetera, that they do bargain over, which is far different than what Dash 5 amendments call for here, which could bring bargaining to an absolute end. I think it's also important to point out that not only am I proud to be an elementary teacher, but I'm real proud of the success that we do have in this state with the students that we serve. I think we're getting real value for our dollars. And one of the ironies with the system is that in teaching, it's one of the few, maybe the only profession around where it takes literally 14 or more years to rise to the professional level of salary. I'm on the board of directors for a very large financial institution. We have salary schedules for our different employees. Nowhere does it take 14 plus years of experience to make it to the professional level of salary. And so, in part, we may have had the beginnings artificially low, but it takes an artificially long period of time to get to that professional level of salary, especially when you consider that these people are not only with their bachelor's, but their master's degree, et cetera, who do provide a tremendous amount of value in addition to administrators and all the support personnel that impact our students. So,
I would agree with you on that particular point. I think you can't hire good teachers at the starting salaries that you're offering. But I think maybe the top is too low, you're too high, but that's just a perception I have, I guess. Okay?
When we negotiated that first compulsory collective bargaining agreement in 1973 or 1974, we started at a level, whatever it was, say it was 15,000 or 17,000 for the top, somewhere around 28,000 to 30,000. And over a period of 30 plus years, no, not that long, 25 years, mm-hmm. we've continued to raise this salary by a percentage. You put a 3% on 15,000 and a 3% on 30,000, and you do that time after time, and now 25 years later, we got 25,000 and 50,000. And so what we've done for ourselves by this kind of lockstep salary increase program, as we've gotten beginning salaries out of whack, top salaries out of whack, not for those teachers who are performing at that level, but for a good many of them who are staying on for the retirement. And it's, to me, a really tough thing to reconcile. You're right, it takes a long time to get up to. We've done it to ourselves by having a lockstep 15-step salary schedule where we park people too low and put them through this 5 to 8% increase in the STEP program. I don't have any further comments, I guess.
Okay. You don't have any either?
No.
Okay. Thank you for the question. See, I guess Steve didn't come up. Maybe we could bring up Trish Smith and Gene Thorne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'll be brief. I agree with what my union colleagues have said. When I wrote this testimony this morning, I was looking at the Dash 2 amendments, but since then I've looked at the Dash 5 amendments, and the same thing applies as far as we're concerned. Senate Bill 1181 and the Dash 5 amendments would roll back public employee collective bargaining and would undermine open and free contract negotiations in school districts and education service districts. And one of the things, I was a teacher years ago at a community college, and I organized faculty, and I remember one thing that stood out in my eyes when I was organizing the faculty 20 years ago, and it was the policy statement that this legislative assembly wrote and stuck in PECBA. And I went back and looked at it this morning when I wrote this, and I don't know if it's changed. It didn't seem like it's changed at all to me, and I found exactly what I was looking for when I read that policy statement. And it says, I wrote it down here, but I'm not going to read all of it, only a sentence that really stands out at me. The Legislative Assembly finds and declares that recognition by public employers of the right of public employees to organize and full acceptance of the principle and procedure of collective negotiation between public employers and public employee organizations can alleviate various forms of strife and unrest. And it was an important sentence for me 20 years ago when I was organizing faculty and for collective bargaining, and it is as well today. And, I think that some folks need to go back and take a look at that. And I want to emphasize full acceptance of the principle and procedure of collective negotiation. And that's what our point is all about. This undermines free collective bargaining. And no matter where the funds are generated or how the funds are generated, what we think as the AFL-CIO is that it's about free collective bargaining, and it should remain just that. It should remain open and free. It's just not the same when it's not. In other states that don't have free collective bargaining, what a lot of the union folks refer to it as is collective begging. Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you for testing. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a labor organization representing more than 16,000 classified school employees in Oregon's K-12 and ESDs. And I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 1181 and particularly the Dash 5 amendments. I'd like to ask you to try to separate and have a look at classified employees in schools in isolation with me for a moment. Classified school employees are the employees in schools who are recruited locally. They're local residents whose children often are going to the schools within the school district, and that is one of the motivating factors of the employees for coming to work for the school district. They are hourly workers for the most part, and their salaries are based upon local market indicators and local costs, labor costs. As Senator Shannon said a little bit ago, when a custodian in Burns negotiates a contract, the cost of his labor will be based upon custodians in other sectors in Burns, not what custodians in Portland are making. They don't recruit custodians in Burns from Portland. They recruit them in Burns.
The Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1181, I believe, for classified employees will set up an artificial percentage, statewide percentage increase in contracts that will take school districts away from that local market determination of classified salaries. After I saw the Dash 2 amendments on Friday and read Section 3, I wanted to get as close as I could to some sort of expert opinion about how the Department of Administrative Services would determine what an allowable growth factor is, as it's outlined in the bill. And so since it was 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, the closest I could come to was Paul Warner, who is our Legislative Revenue Office and was at one time, as you know, the economist for the state of Oregon. And I took the language to him, and I asked him if he were given the task of determining how this allowable growth factor were to be determined under Section 3, how would that occur? He indicated that there was nothing like this anywhere in Oregon, and that it would have to be created over what he suspected would be a kind of a complicated, drawn-out process where various experts from various fields, including economists and school district experts, etc., would come together and try to develop something, a percentage, a single percentage, that could then be applied to all the school districts in the state. I would suggest to you for that for classified, as I said earlier, you will be creating, you will be moving away from that which you seek. If you seek to keep salaries and to establish salaries at a reasonable, locally based point, you're there with classified employees. And this language will move you away from that. In addition to our concerns about how total combined compensation would be calculated under the Dash 5 amendments, we're also very concerned about Section 4.3c, which seems to say that the only, and was confirmed by the individual from OSVA, that the only issues which would be negotiated in a contract are monetary issues. If I read the bill completely, the understanding I get is that should this pass, as of January 1st in the year 2000, whatever your contract says for non-economic issues is what your contract will say forevermore. There will be no negotiation of non-economic issues. For classified employees, that could be a very detrimental thing for school districts. And the reason for that is that there are more than 100 different classifications of classified employees in school districts, and they're changing all the time. Changing conditions in schools, changing conditions in the world from differences in technology and the difference in the way services are delivered require that classifications be modified fairly frequently. These classifications are modified through the collective bargaining process. I brought a copy of the book of classifications of school district employees. There, as I said, are more than 100 of them. Pay equity is another example of an issue that is an issue for classified employees. That could not be dealt with if this amendment passes. There are many, many non-economic issues which need to be addressed between employees and management in school districts frequently, and the collective bargaining process allows us to do this. Subsection C, line 6 and page 4, which eliminates our ability to bargain non-economic issues, I think does not only not serve classified employees, it doesn't serve schools, and it doesn't serve the legislature, because it takes away the flexibility that schools need to make the changes that the community requires, and also the changes that the legislature requires. When I listened to the committee earlier talk about its concern, legitimate concern, about the cost of education, I seem to hear that there is a belief that the increase in the cost of education is all as a result of increases in school district employee salaries.
classified employee salaries included. Two points. The first point is the reality about our compensation. Classified school employees, OSEA members, there are about 16,000 of them. 57.8% of them make less than $1,500 a month. They work 9 months a year. They work an hourly wage. They're not eligible for unemployment insurance, and they don't have a nice 9 month cushy job that pays them for 12. These are people that you're talking about with this bill, and I hope that you will include them in your thoughts as you're deciding what should be done. Because when you talk about high salaries in schools, certainly the superintendent of Salem's Kaiser School and all of his principals make more than the governor, but the custodians barely make enough to feed their families. There is a great difference in employees in schools, and to lump them all together in this bill is inappropriate. The second point that I wanted to make about that is Mr. Marshall indicated that one of the reasons that this bill is needed is because in the good old days before Measure 5, all the school districts bargained with all of their employees, and the local community was involved in that, and they decided what was paid and what wasn't, and it all worked fine. And now, after Measure 5, school districts don't have the ability to bargain with their classified employees anymore on an equal footing, which we find ironic given the folks that my classified employees have to sit across the table from. They're generally far better prepared than we are. However, the alternative or the balance, or they said, on one end we have the old days where local school districts bargained contracts. We could go to statewide bargaining where y'all would bargain the contract. But this is a better balance, the Dash 5. I suggest to you that in either of those first two scenarios, classified school employees had a voice. They had a voice when they have a voice now when they bargain with local school districts. They would even have a voice if you set up a statewide collective bargaining system. But if you pass this amendment to this bill, they will no longer have a voice at all, because school districts will decide under the language of the bill that what they had before is what they will have plus this artificial growth factor. So for classified school employees, we don't believe for any employee in the school that this is the right way to go. There are other ways to deal with the problems. There are a lot of other issues besides salaries included in the additional cost. One of them is mandates. School districts are the only governments that aren't protected from legislative mandates, and as we've seen this session, the legislature is very free with mandates that cost money. Those are costs that school districts can't control either. There are other issues besides salaries in increased costs for schools. 21st century school reform is a tremendous cost to schools, and this isn't the solution to any of those costs. And it does, in fact, transfer the blame to people who have the least ability to fix it. So with that, I will pass the mic on to the lady at the left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Thorne, the Governor's Education Workforce Policy Advisor. I'd like to today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 1181 and to the Dash 5 amendments, but also to offer the Governor's amendments, which are Dash 3, that he believes would address his concerns with the bill. As you know, the Governor has spoken publicly about his opposition to the concept of a qualified economic offer, because it, in essence, does take away collective bargaining rights. At the same time, he does believe that there is at least a perceived disconnect between decisions being made at the local level and the revenue source for those spending decisions. I noticed this morning in the paper that there was an article saying that the amendments, which were first, I guess, the Dash 2, have been described as being closer to the governor's perspective. I would say in one way, and probably only one way, are they closer than the original bill. And in the original bill, there was a flat percentage increase, and in the Dash 5, it does give the responsibility to the Department of Administrative Services to establish the type of increase that would be necessary. But I believe that the still two primary concerns the governor would have on the Dash 5 is that it does only focus on personal services spending, and it also continues to take away those collective bargaining rights. So it's no longer called qualified economic offer, but the concept is the same. It is true that personal services do constitute the vast majority of expenditures of school districts, but it is not the only part of the school district budget. Governor believes the focus needs to be broad enough to include the entire local school district budget, both in terms of looking at major spending decisions that may affect other areas, such as technology and transportation, and also looking at ways to offset the spending decisions that are being made. One of the problems that we are told is a problem with the current system is that while districts are trying to do budgeting and negotiate various agreements, whether they be collective bargaining agreements or agreements for transportation services or technology or other kinds of services, they have to do it in a vacuum because it's not until after the governor's budget is presented that they have some sense of what at least a continuing service or current service level budget would be. And so we present the current service level budget and any other additions that may be proposed, and then are told, as you are told, well, we've made commitments that put us in excess at the local district level of those figures. We believe the amendments in Dash 3 will address this issue. The amendments require that the state superintendent of public instruction, and we have had a discussion with Stan Bunn about this, will consult with the Department of Administrative Services, Legislative Fiscal Office, and Legislative Revenue Office, and provide school districts an estimate of the revenue they should be able to expect on a per-student basis for the next three fiscal years, and this will be based on a current service level calculation. And so, for instance, in March of 2000, we would be presenting school districts with a run that would show them, here's what at a current service level would be estimated to be your share on a per student basis for school years 2000-2001 or 102 and 02-03. This doesn't mean the governor and the legislature can't recommend, can't authorize expenditures less than current service level or more than current service level. But we would anticipate they'd be in policy packages just as we are for state agencies now. But what it would do is provide a context for school districts as they're making these decisions. They could then enter into these longer-term agreements, again, whether it's around collective bargaining or other types of spending, but they would do it within a context of knowing how much should they reasonably be able to expect funding that would be available. So they would not be doing making these spending decisions in a vacuum. If the decisions would cause the district to exceed the amount of funding that is estimated to be available during that time period, then the district, before it would finalize that agreement, first would need to report locally. What are the offsets that they would propose in order to fund this? They're going to go to a new technology project. What does that mean? If that's going to put them $1 million, $2 million over the budget, what are they going to do? Are they going to increase class size to deal with that? Again, it would force the accountability locally. So the district would first have to explain to its local patrons what the real trade-offs are in that community. Can't merely be an exercise in making some commitments and then coming to the governor and legislature and saying, we've made these commitments, it's now time for you to provide us the funding. So we believe it requires districts to make explicit decisions about the commitments they're making for longer-term spending. We believe the process we've outlined in the Dash 3 amendments allows for the context that should be welcomed by school districts when they're making these decisions. We believe it provides a level of accountability to local patrons that's absent from the current process, and we also believe it does provide better protections to state-level policymakers that decisions that are being made locally will not merely transfer to the state for a cry for increased revenues. So we would ask the opposition to 1181 and the Dash 5 in the support of the Dash 3.
Thank you.
Thank you. you made reference in your comments to current service level or estimating. I don't see that in the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, in looking at, there is not a specific reference to current service level. There isn't a definition of current service level, as I understand it, in statute currently. And so we basically, on page 1, lines 8 through 11, would be an estimate of the amount of revenue from the state school fund, local revenues, the district program or entity will have available in each of the next 3 fiscal years. The intent would be to try to also have the definition, and again, it's not in statute, it's a programmatic definition, of current service level as it's being developed between Department of Administrative Services and Legislative Fiscal Office, really be more consistent between how we deal with the state school fund and how we would deal with state agencies in developing a current service level estimate.
You're talking about an overall budget now. We're talking about the 85%, which is salaries.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking now about an overall limitation.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. What would stop, the biggest complaint that we get seems to be very often touched with all today, is not current books. What would stop a school district from negotiating all this money away in salaries and still not having nothing left for books or supplies?
Mr. Chair, I believe that if school districts have a budget for each school year,
mm-hmm.
and so let's say they have a budget for this next school year, 2000-2001, and let's say there's, excuse me, 0-0, but so they know how much is in that budget. If they were to decide for future years that, and this is where the department or the state superintendent has provided them an estimate of how much should be available. If basically they negotiate a collective bargaining agreement and there's no room for anything else, then they would have to go back locally and explain that although we've had a line item expenditures for instructional materials and it's been at X amount, it's now zero.
They went back and explained it and they said, well, that's tough. So where do you go from there? What's the teeth in your proposal that would require them to maintain a certain level of expenditure? You can't rule. I don't believe that you're going to get control by just saying, well, you ought to do this.
Mr. Chair, I think it's interesting in terms of thinking about the teeth here versus perhaps the teeth in the dash 5. It was mentioned that only 5% of the school districts, or I guess it was 5% of the employees in Wisconsin, are under agreements that were made as qualified economic offer. So, in essence, the legislature, if you want to put it that way, only has had 5% use some teeth, and it's unilateral teeth, frankly, between the board and the employees. What this does is require that locally they're going to have, before the school district undertakes a commitment for longer-term funding, whether it be collective bargaining or some type of other commitment, they're going to have to explain to their patrons, this means that your child's class is going to be larger, or this means we're no longer going to have certain elections. So they have to, not necessarily, that currently they can make funding commitments on the hope that in the out years where they don't have any information yet about how much funding will be available, that the legislature will come up with that information. So we're trying to marry that.
Yeah, what's going to happen if they say, I'm sorry, we have to spend more than our budget?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I missed.
Well, we're going through the same thing right now. I mean, we talked about current service levels in schools today would be 4.5. The government's asking for 4.95.
And I think, Mr. Chair, I think there is a disagreement. The current service level is a figure that was established. It was established, frankly.
What's going to stop if we go to dash 3 and the current service level is we got to say 4.7, this time it's 4.8, and you say, no, I'm sorry, we need 4.9. What's to stop us? There's no way of ever controlling the growth by just saying, gee, we don't want you to spend more than this.
I think, Mr. Chair, if well in advance of having a the budget presented to the legislature. We have agreement among legislative, fiscal, revenue, and Department of Administrative Services, along with the Department of Education. What are the inflators? School districts receive that information. In many ways, it's similar to what we have for state agencies right now under the current service level definition. And state agencies also know it may be less than that. It's not often more than that. But this gives them, I guess, there isn't an excuse of being able to say, well, we didn't know how much we might have, and we already made the commitment. This provides the context, saying this is how much you knew in advance was a reasonable estimate of current service level. And so if there were commitments you made that went beyond that, that is not the responsibility of the state legislature to fund. That doesn't mean the state legislature can't say, but there are additional activities that we want or additional types of things we want our schools to do and to have policy packages in excess of that.
Well, personally, I don't see how these six positions would work. Maybe you have more confidence in just telling people why to be doing this instead of saying that there's no consequences if they don't do it. Absolutely no consequences at all in the proposal.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What's interesting, the dash five, what I see there is the report that is made doesn't even say how would I balance. If the report is one that is made because the negotiation is in excess of the amount, it is merely giving a rationale for why that excess is there. It doesn't require the local school district to also come forward with a plan of how would they balance the expenditures locally. I think one of the things that I've become more cognizant of and being more familiar with what's going on in other states and accountability mechanisms is that one of the strongest accountability mechanisms really is the local public and for them to understand the ramifications of the spending decisions so that they're not making those decisions in a vacuum.
Well, I think they shouldn't be made in a vacuum now because everyone can figure out what current service levels are. The school board is moving first to go what the current service level was before the governor figured it out. And when the governor figured out, he said the current service level would be 4.5. We're now talking about 4.95, which is a far cry from the current service level. And there's nothing that would stop that. You know, we could say current service level next time is 4.8 or whatever it might be, but there's nothing to stop the governor or people coming in and say, well, that's not enough, give us more, which is exactly what's happening today.
Mr. Chair, I believe the first time school districts knew what current service level might mean for their individual budgets, I believe, was after the governor's budget was issued.
Well, okay. You mean to tell me
we're
that school boards don't think of that in the future? I mean, they wait for the governor to say what the current service level is going to be?
Mr. Chair, that's the first time we had heard, I guess, the concerns raised by school districts that the amount the governor was providing for current service level was not going to be sufficient to cover their current service. What individual districts said.
What would cause that not to happen next time?
Mr. Chair, I think what we would be doing is providing information to them in about 9 months in advance of when they might normally have it. And in fact, if we were providing something in March of 2000, it would be for actually the 01, yes, that's about 9 months in advance when they would be receiving
it. But if we can figure out, why can't the school district figure it out? Why do they not? They certainly would be able to figure it out long before we would. They know what the cost of going
to. Mr. Chair, I think that, and I'm sorry, there wasn't a budget person able to come here with me today who works on the intricacies of the budgeting system at the state level, but that the final decisions on current service level were not made until further into the process. And so what this would do would be to force that process earlier to have on the table what are the kinds of indicators that are being used and what are the kinds of factors that then are being used to inflate the budget so that they would have.
And we're predicting our budget out 2 years all the time. I would be able to sit down. I'm not a mathematician, but I could sit down and figure out what the current service level is up to be in 2 years from now.
Well, I do know, Mr. Chair, that when the runs were done on the current service level budget after the governor's budget was submitted, there were a number of districts who said they were surprised that it was at how low the figures were for their districts, so it wasn't sufficient. What this does is basically say, that excuse won't be out there. We will have the figures. You'll be making decisions within that context.
But there's nothing to require them to maintain that level of payment. I mean, there's no reason we would go above that.
Mr. Chair, if they are going to go above that, then they have to provide a plan locally to their community of how they're going to live within their budget.
It appears by given the advanced information that we have that much longer for them to make the case that this is insufficient.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, if that information is provided now, under this, if it's provided 9 months in advance, I believe it will be hard for them to come back 9 months later and say, oh, it just dawned on us that this is not enough, and this is not enough, and we've made commitments that exceed that amount.
Yeah. We've had, just now, we've had 5 months to make the case that the amount available is not adequate. If it's 9 months, then we've got 9 months to make the case. You don't believe that that same scenario would apply?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not going to be so naive as to say no one's going to say this isn't enough money and we need more money. But I believe that the arguments of we've made commitments are in excess, and so we need more money. It's not because we didn't know how much would be available. It's not an argument that under this scenario would be one that could be made, I don't believe. Now, there may be other rationale for why a school district may say there isn't enough money. It may be added requirements have been imposed. It may be other factors that relate to the distribution formula as opposed to the overall funding.
Okay. Thank you.
Are we having nothing in the mail?
Hmm?
We have another guest for tomorrow? Oh, can I have it posted for tomorrow too?
Yeah, possible.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on
It would have taken the classified employees out. Can we talk about that? The dash four, you didn't talk about
it? We did not.
She says we did.
Well, she wanted to pick, she didn't want to pick that side out.
That's mine.
What would be the advantage?
What is the advantage for food that there might be higher paid custodians in areas and less of them because we have to pay the Portland way?
No, you would definitely have to go there.
Yeah.
Because you shouldn't go up more than a certain percentage. You're paying $100 a month now. And it says you can raise them, she said they're going to say a 4-point increase. They go from 100 to 104. They go from 106 to 4, and they go 6 points.
You've got
to figure
that out, okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll make a motion if you want a motion.
Okay.
I'll move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1181.
Okay. Senator Bruce moved the dash 3 amendments to 1181. Any discussion on that three amendments? Okay, could we have a roll call vote, please?
What are you going to discuss?
You want to discuss anything?
I would like Governor to say that this has no lit and no way of limiting future growth. It is not the amendments that I would desire to see in the final bill.
Sure, I think
for a long time, the school districts have asked us to give them some idea, longer term than we do, of what they're going to have available. And I think this helps them to do that so they can do what they're legally obligated to do. And they're legally obligated to put out a budget. I think it also engages us in some longer term look at school funding than we are now. And everything we're doing continues the long-term dilemma of, are school boards responsible? And if they're not, we might as well get rid of them. And if they are, then they deserve the right to know what it is they're going to get and to be able to work within that. And we have to assume that the local people will deal with their local school boards if they go too far afield. I mean, I found some of the early discussion today amazing, just as I did the other day. I mean, it just seems to me that it's headed more and more towards saying that local school boards can't do their job. I know some of them feel irrelevant these days, but I don't know any of them that think they can't do their job, and I think this helps to enable them to do that.
Well, I would say yes to it. I could join a church service over 2 years from now. It wouldn't be that hard to do. But it would really make any difference in what city they came up with, what they need. And so I don't know, by giving the figures 5 months or 6 months or a year from now, they're making a difference in how they figure what they're going to spend. For the building in course, I think any school district could figure out very quickly, approximately, what the current service level would be 2 years from now.
But the way we did school funding last time, they couldn't count on what a current service level budget would be this time. We gave them so much money in the state school fund, they only gave them two other pots of money that were not rolled into the school fund, so we're not considered part of current service level.
Those were capital expenses.
Right. Mm-hmm. But we did it telling the school districts, take out whatever you were going to spend for that out of your regular budget and then backfill with this. So we knew that it was part of their ongoing.
You're saying even though it was capital expenditures, they used it for current service?
We told them to. I remember the discussions when we said, computers, whatever you've got in your budget for computers, pull that out. Same thing for textbooks, pull that out. And use this money for that, so that even though it's not for ongoing operations, it frees up money for ongoing operations. So it did turn into part of their, or at least some of it turned into part of their regular operating expenses. And in terms of otherwise, some of those school districts would have been really stretched. But yet it wasn't part of current service level, and it wasn't treated that way, so they couldn't assume that it was going to be there. You know, some of the discussions I've heard thrown out this session in terms of school funding make me wonder if we're going to be back in the same situation with more one-pot solution.
Well, I would disagree with you that they didn't know what the current service level would be. I would agree with you they didn't know how much you were going to give them. And I don't think this clears that up either. You still are not going to say what we're going to give them, but as far as figuring out the current service level, that would not be difficult to do. And if you're guaranteeing that they're all going to give us current service level, that might be different.
Not a chance.
No, that's the point.
I'm still looking for a functioning science lab in my high school.
They still do not know how many dollars they're going to have, even though we give them current service level 6 months from now.
The dash three amendment, in fact, takes the legislature out of the process until we come together and decide at what level we will fund public education. Mm-hmm. And what relationship that has to this figure that's put forward two years in advance by the Department of Education might bear very little resemblance. In any event, you provide the advocates for more teacher salaries to advocate that this, in fact, will not be enough to meet our needs. Or the kinds of increases that were
designed.
Well, if the Department of Education can already give them a 3-year advance of what current service level is to be, anyone can do that, but that doesn't say how much we're going to spend. And the reason that they don't know, they can't budget because they don't know if you want to project yourself in the future, we're going to fund it at current service level, then they can plan to do that. But what the DASC does is what we presently do. Basically, that's it.
I have a question.
Okay.
If these are the governors, does this still have a life after we don't reject these? And if so, if it doesn't, maybe we need to consider sending this out to the people. Because I think we waste a lot of time if we're just going for a veto plan.
Well, it's not a way to be able to go through the process, so we need to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a little problem with a little bump at the end of the process.
Okay.
It might have a bump, like a veto pin.
Okay.
I don't think we should send it there.
I'm fine with that.
It's good legislation, and he's not with us. Let's take another route.
That's quite what I had in mind.
No. Motion failed. Now, you have the -4.
Mm-hmm.
Or the -4 is in conflict with the -5. And I'm not sure that would accomplish what you really want to accomplish.
Well, I do have a concern, and maybe we can work out on the house.
Okay.
Okay. So we move the -5?
Mm-hmm.
I move the -5 amendment to...
Okay, any discussion?
Senate Bill 1181.
Okay. Have a roll call vote, please.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No. Aye.
Okay. I move Senate Bill 1181 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Okay. Heavy. Four, please.
Senator
Wild?
No.
Senator
Shannon?
Aye.
Senator
Gates?
No.
Senator
Gates? Aye. Okay. Is it going to
carry
it? No, it's just vote against him.
But they don't work at our expense.
What did you have to have?
You change the purse benefits down here.
Okay.
And so I'm hoping that this process is actually going to potentially that initial current service level. But to say that our people knew what the current service level would be. It's never been. You apply it to the whole thing, and then we distribute it differently based on the same. So, it's about history. And that's why they came up with the difference between what their current service level versus what was created by the action. So, I hope before we truly list that. but that's in the governor's hands, I think. It wasn't in this very well, but I think it's on their plate. And I hope that gives some fair expression. So I think it's really worthwhile, because we're talking